reviews, and then Helena's going to do some fanning. So anything you want to...
Something, I guess.
On something.
On something.
You're going to have to work hard out, too. What was it? Glass blowing, blacksmithing, and
yeah,
something falconry. Last week. Falconry.
I don't like birds, Chris.
What does that have to do with anything?
God. You probably also want me burnt. You don't like being burnt by molten glass either, but hey.
Never going to take
Or stick your hands into a furnace. It's 7,000 degrees Kelvin.
Like literally the only thing I'm afraid of. Fucking birds, man. Jesus Christ.
All right, let's get this thing rolling and make it official. I'm Charles Breton.
I'm Helena Epstein.
And I'm Chris Henson. Together we are
a Jew
and
a Gentile walking to
a bar
mitzvah.
Welcome in at episode 127. And welcome to the podcast where you'll find the theology, the cigars, the whiskeys, and the F-bombs. Although the Gentile says he's going to swear off the F-bombs because he wants to, quote, increase our listenership.
Really?
Yeah.
I said that last week.
I'm not sure the F-bombs is what keep people away from us, though.
When did we have that conversation? That feels like a consensus needs to be had.
Sweetheart, you were high on COVID meds last week.
Oh, that's right. That's what happened.
And Slappy's chicken.
Just wait till you listen to the podcast like, oh my God, I was out of my mind.
We also had that conversation when you were kind of, you know, in a Slappy's coma.
No, that's true. We weren't recording in a Slappy's coma.
I know, but we were still talking about this. Anyway, our podcast is available on Stitcher, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts. You can also hear us on Theology Corner at theologycorner.net. We're also very proud to be part of the Wild Goose Goosecast Network, a network of faith-based podcasts discussing issues of inclusion and social justice. And it's managed by the man, the legend, the Velvet Mist, Russ Jennings. So if you'd like to learn more about the Wild Goose Festival, go to wildgoose.org. And in our guest spotlight, we have a guest tonight for this one. We have the Reverend Daniel Brereton, Anglican priest, Canadian, hoser.
Good
person overall.
From Illinois.
No, those are Hoosers.
Those are from Indiana. And they're Hoosers.
They're Hoosers from Indiana. That's a hoser, eh? Get your Canadian right.
Oh, God.
Apparently, when you're thinking of moving to Canada, you did not do your research well. Did you watch any episodes of The Great White North?
No, wasn't supposed to.
Yes, that's how you learn everything Canadian.
Shit, I'm going to have to tell them.
Anyway, Reverend Daniel, welcome to this craziness we call a podcast.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So we're at the point where we do our shout outs, sponsors, and shameless plugs. So shout outs to some of these are people who make this podcast possible. Virgil Cane Rye Whiskey, the official whiskey of Jew and a Gentile. They make this podcast possible because it's after drinking several of, you know, Rye Manhattans, can the Gentile actually listen to this a second time and edit it?
That's true. Yeah.
That is true. That is true. Yes.
You don't edit our podcasts. Is that true?
I have edited this podcast with the aid of many substances over the years.
Most of them legal, though. We didn't want to
all of them legal and prescribed, taken appropriately. But
yeah, it's the only way to get through it.
The deep Ambien cuts.
Says the girl from last week that doesn't remember last week's podcast. Yeah.
You know.
Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, our favorite brick and mortar in Winston-Salem. Bethany and J.D. Miller. We also want to send our condolences to J.D., whose mother passed recently. So. JD, we are thinking of you and your family. And as my people would say, may her memory be of a blessing and may you find comfort among all who mourn in Zion. I do want to shout out actually to what is becoming one of my favorite semi-brick and mortars, which is Neptune Cigars in Miami. They are a brick and mortar, but they have an online presence. So they're not like CI, which is trying to take over the world. And I only order from them things that I can't get at Top Leaf because I'd rather support my local brick and mortar. But being from Miami, I don't feel as bad ordering from Neptune. They really have a good selection and their customer service is really nice. The cigars have always come fresh, humidified. They put humid packs in everything. And I'm really becoming a fan of theirs. So I just wanted to shout out to them. Also, our good friend, Natalie Rubley, imagine Nat, and all the wonderful crafts and sewing classes she runs. If you've listened to our music, our open and close music, that's from Ethan Sapphire. And you can find him at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire. And of course, Jawworks, doing great work by bringing sustainable tourism and clean drinking water to Jamaica, which most people don't realize there's a lot more to Jamaica than the 0.1% you see as a tourist. Megan and TJ do a great job with that. And in a little bit, I'm going to give a shout out to our favorite cigar reviewer who is not on this podcast.
We got Cigar Coop?
Yes.
Good.
Okay, thanks for blowing that tease.
Right.
Spoilers, Chris. Spoilers.
So let's get to that then. Then, Chris, what are you smoking?
I picked it up at the Top Leaf a couple weeks ago and brought it to your house for the smoking and the eating of fried chicken this past weekend. The Guardian of the Farm Night Watch, which just sounds much more, I don't know.
Games of Thrones-y?
Yeah, right. The winter is coming. It's just a brilliant cigar. I mean, we've had the regular Guardian of the Farm, but this is, again, Nicaraguan Puro wrappers, Nicaraguan Jalapa Shade, grown Corojo Maduro, Nicaraguan Jalapa Corojo Binder, and Nicaraguan Corojo and Crio from Jalapa and Esteli Filler, and it is a really, really great cigar. I risked, you know, third-degree burns just to get through the last little bit of it, because I could not have the presence of mind to ask for something to stick the last little bit on. Great toast-tasting notes, mocha, earth, because it's Nicaraguan, of course, because they have earthy notes to it. Red pepper, cedar, and it's just sort of some coffee and chocolate and leather, actually, at one point. But what really got me was the taste of, like, toast. You know, we actually talked with Charles, like, it's like the Hoya de Nicaragua Red Label or something like that. And this had elements of that in it, too. Definitely would buy it again. I thought when I picked it up, I just grabbed a regular Gardens and Farm. I'm glad I made the mistake of getting something different this time. Mm-hmm. Definitely would smoke it again.
Well, at the suggestion of Cigar Coop, the Cigar Coop podcast, if you're not listening, if you want some excellent, not pretentious cigar reviews, then check out Cigar Coop. He's got a podcast. William Cooper's got a podcast. He's got a website. Does a great job. So recently he had reviewed the Crowned Heads Las Calaveras 2020 Special Edition. And after reading his review, as I often do, I go out and get the cigar. And this is really good. It's an Ecuadorian Habano Escura wrapper. It's the third in the series since they started in 2014 to have an Ecuadorian Habano Escura and Nicaraguan binder and filler. Flavors, tasting notes, you get earth, citrus, cocoa, black pepper, natural tobacco. And you get a lot of those just moving in and out, trading places into the superiority. But what got me, and this is directly from Cigar Coop's review. It says, quote, "While I know a lot of people hold the 2014 release in high regard, I would still give the edge to the 2020 edition. In terms of performance at the time it was assessed, the 2020 edition gets the nod. This is a well-balanced cigar that delivered excellent flavor." That's really high praise. I know a lot of people who are aficionados of it. They wait anxiously every year for the new Las Calaveras. The 2014 is pretty much everyone's favorite. Some people were a little disappointed in the 2018 and 2019. So for him to compare it that favorably to the 2014 is really saying something. And I am really enjoying it. It is excellent. There is a lot of it that does remind you of the 2014. But this one seems to be rolled a little loose. There's a lot of smoke and the draw is flawless. Quite enjoying it. Helena, I know you've given up the weed, tobacco, that is, but you need to unmute yourself.
Sure, she gave up the other one too, so.
Right, yeah. But you do have, obviously, giving up the unmuting. There you go. Mm-hmm. So what's the ampersand of reason obsessed with this week? Oh, sorry. I forgot a special shout out to Slappy's Fried Chicken in Winston-Salem.
That shit is good.
That is excellent. We finally got us some Slappy's.
We keep hanging out on Sundays for some reason, which is fun, but Slappy's isn't open on Sundays.
Yeah.
So
they observe your Sabbath, not mine.
They do. Yep. So I gosh, Lord have mercy. I don't even really know. This week's been kind of a blur between COVID, that COVID vaccine, which really did knock me on my ass. And then my neighbor got really sick the next night and I was at the ER, like, and then it's just been a weird week. But the only thing that really caught my attention was the Monstera Deliciosa plant, which is also known as the Swiss cheese plant. I went to the garden store because that's where I go when I'm stressed out. And they had a little one with like these, well, y'all can't see my fingers.
Love is just hand motion. There we go.
I know. Yeah. I'm like trying to show everybody how big they are. But the store had ones that were maybe like 3 to 5 inches or the size of your palm. And I was like, I'm not going to. Okay, no, Helena, don't spend money. Don't spend the money. Don't spend the money. Then I went home and I started Googling. And so it's called a Swiss cheese plant because there's like these holes in it as the like leaves mature, and they're really cool. They're shaped like giant plates. So so they're pretty easily propagatable in water and then into soil. And I have one coming now from California that is a leaf with some aerial roots that have grown on it that is like a 13-inch long leaf. So I'm super excited about that. That's going to be really cool. I'll show you guys when it comes. Well, y'all can see it. Yeah. Our listeners can hear about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It can really be the official plant of the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
the prayer plant should probably be, you know, the prayer plant, like it wraps its leaves up at nighttime. Oh, tobacco yes. leaves are probably the official plant. Yeah. Anyways, that's really the only thing that caught my eye all week, which is not much, you know, all things considered.
You know, folks, so she's a simple girl.
It's Monday. I mean, come on.
She's a simple girl, simple pleasures, doesn't take much. Show her a growing leaf of something and she's off there. Off you go.
It's a really fucking cool plant. And if it takes well, it'll turn into like a big, it'll be huge.
Again, the hand motions are lost on.
I lost on our listeners, but my arms are over my head. Like, it's going to be a big plant if it does what I want it to do. It's going to be super cool. So
you can tell Helena is a geek like that, because never even mentioned Super Bowl being last night. Of course, it wasn't much to it. I would rather watch the plant grow. But sports ball was on last night.
Yeah, you guys were talking about sports ball last night, weren't you? Or was that about something? No, you were talking about Monty Python.
That was my pregame show was watching Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
The ending was less predictable in that movie.
Yeah. Let's not argue over who killed who. Supposed to be a happy occasion. Rev Daniel, anything you want to geek out about, fan about, life in the Great White North?
Definitely not the Super Bowl. I didn't watch that either. So, nothing to give a shout out to.
Okay, all right. Did one of our favorite guests? So I guess a shout out to Phil freaking Wyman. Did have to point out that Scotland beat England in the Seven Nations tour. So I was like,
rugby.
Yeah, man's game. He also did mention Wales because that's his team, but I got excited because it was Scotland. That's my team.
Why Scotland?
How did you come to have a rugby team?
Right. Yeah.
Well, partly because
I played Scotland or Charles.
Yeah. Scotland.
Scotland. Okay. Yeah, no.
So I was introduced to Scotland in elementary and middle school, because my PE teacher played for the Miami Rugby Club, which is the rugby interscholastic NCAA rugby team in the University of Miami. So he taught us to play rugby. And
right. Rugby's so badass.
It is such a spectacular sport.
She should take that up.
Yeah. You should take that up.
Both of my brothers played, and I was so jealous that we didn't have rugby where I went to school. I would have played in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
My brother like burst a kid's fucking eardrum once and it was like not a foul. Like whatever happened.
Yeah.
It was like not a foul. I was like, that is so badass.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. And you know, wear a headband over your ears or they will get bitten in the scrum.
Yeah. Yeah. Rugby's cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, can we start using the phrase bitten in the scrum for other purposes? That's like magical right there, man.
Oh, just well, no, that is a no context
hashtag.
Hashtag ear
bitten in the scrum.
In the scrum.
Leave the ear off, Charles.
Yeah, hashtag. Just bitten in the scrum is way
bitten
more.
In the scrum
bitten in the scrum.
Bitten in the scrum.
End of conversation.
Yeah.
To be added to our other phrases like punching the lasagna and nudging the swamp donkey.
Ew.
And shower omelets.
I don't remember shower omelets.
I don't remember the swamp donkey.
Did you just mention? No, we talked about that Saturday when you were probably looking at plants.
Okay, I just missed part of that conversation.
We should probably move on to like something more intellectual.
Right? We have company. See, this is why we can't
we're
have
being
nice
really
things.
Bad hosts. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I have some questions.
Oh, I suspect you do.
Yeah.
Feel free to ask
it anytime.
We'll answer anything. We have very poor filters.
And now for something completely different.
Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey started with one goal, to create the best damn whiskey around. Drawing on their culinary know-how and driven by flavor, founders David and Ryan, both accomplished chefs, were inspired to boldly blend, infuse, and tinker with choice ingredients to craft category-shattering whiskeys, proving that it's not about stuffy tradition, but about taking what you know and taking chances. Each of their spirits is a tribute to their dedication to making whiskey their way, a whiskey they'd want to drink. Again, Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey, a damn fine whiskey.
Rev Daniels here because, as our longtime listener knows, the raison d'etre for a Jew and a Gentile walking to a bar mitzvah is discussing mental health, mental illness, trying to, as in our own little ways, help with the stigmas, to remove those stigmas. One of the best ways you do that is you talk openly about it. And the three of us have talked very openly over several episodes, several blog posts about it, about our depression, bipolar. We also look at not just sharing those stories, but from time to time, put it within the lens of mental health and it being in a faith community, because those two things can sometimes make either easier or more difficult. So we've invited Rev Daniel to come and to begin with, just share his story. And we'll go from there. Daniel, the podcast is yours.
I think one of the things that I've that being on Twitter for me as a priest, as someone representing and part of a faith community, it's just been really important to me to sort of be myself and to share, you know, as well as thoughts on theology and church and all that kind of stuff, but also just giving people a glimpse into my life, because, you know, people will listen to you if they have a sense of who you are and they can trust who you are and that you know what you're talking about. And so part of that has been talking also about my struggles with depression, my own struggles with mental health. It's interesting actually, as open as I have been about lots of things, including my sexuality, including, you know, criticisms of the church and other things, when it came to actually talking about my depression, I was really hesitant about that. Like that was the thing I was most worried about sharing openly, because of the stigma around that. And I think also, about the whole issue around like employment, you know, like being open about the fact that you struggle with a mental health issue, and how does that make you look in terms of your competency as a leader? Is your boss going to see this tweet? You know, will this go on your record? Will they remember this when it comes time to talk about you know, promotions or giving you another job or whatever. And the very fact that I was so afraid to talk about that, for me, just underlined the issue of stigma and why we do need to talk about it. And the response to my opening up about that was phenomenal in terms of people sharing their own stories, but also just being grateful that somebody from a faith community was talking about that. Interestingly, just this past week, our church is still closed to physical worship because of the COVID thing. So everything is online. And since the pandemic started, I've been doing like an email blast to my congregation every week. And last week, I decided just to sort of preface it with some stuff about mental health. And I didn't say anything all that profound. It was simply about, you know, having taking care of your mental health. You know, here are some resources if people are struggling. But the biggest issue was just that, you know, as your pastor, I want to say, if you're struggling with depression, anxiety, other mental health issues, that is not a failure of your faith. It's not something you can pray away. It's not a sign that God has abandoned you. You know, so things that I thought were pretty standard things to say. And I have a pretty liberal, progressive congregation. So I didn't think any of that would be huge for them. But the response to me saying that was kind of surprising, actually. You know, just like the number of people who really struggled with being open about their mental health illnesses, their struggle around being open in the faith community because the stigma around that. And all I could think was, if that's where my congregation is at, like, what is it like for someone coming from a more conservative evangelical background where they do hear things like, you know, if you had a stronger faith, if you believed more in Jesus, you wouldn't have that demon of depression. So yeah, it definitely is an important thing for the church, for faith communities of all types to keep talking about.
Amen, man. I had to hold back some amens. Let you finish. That was my experience. Yeah. And I'm so glad you mentioned, because it's different in an Episcopal system where you're getting appointed, and I'm assuming that's what the Anglican tradition is in Canada. Yeah. And you have, you know, the official United Methodist policy, or I should say this a little softer, the unofficial is, we encourage you to stay mentally well, but if you happen to get mentally unwell, don't talk about it. Because who are you going to talk to? Because your colleagues could be your boss the next go around.
Yep.
Yeah, man, right on.
I mean, even in my tradition, I certainly have seen this. I think it's getting better. But I've certainly seen it where, just like you're saying, the official line is take care of your mental health and we're here for you if you're struggling. But it also gets noted and, you know, you are now a problem, a possible problem to deal with. So our church sort of speaks out of both sides, two sides of their mouth at the same time, too. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's funny how issues around how mental health is seen so differently from physical health, right? You know, no one in my church, although, I mean, this is certainly not true of all traditions, but because I remember when I've also had cancer and I struggled with that earlier on in my 20s. And I remember at the time, and I had just sort of come out publicly as a gay man. And I do remember a friend of my then brother-in-law who was very involved in his evangelical church, coming up to me and saying, you know, so I heard you have cancer and you're being treated for that. And he's like, yeah, yeah. And he's like, I'd like to pray for you. I was like, that'd be cool. And then he goes, did you think that maybe God's letting you have cancer because he's trying to send you a message? And at first I was like, what are you talking about? Like, what kind of message? And then all of a sudden I started putting it together and thinking, oh, this is a gay thing. But other than that, you know, my experience with physical illness, I've never had anyone in the church link that with punishment from God or a sign of, you know, lack of faith. But when it comes to mental health, it's a whole different story. And even, like I was saying, even people who I think have been in a fairly liberal, progressive kind of faith community still somehow have that message that, you know, their depression or their mental health illnesses are linked to faith or lack of faith somehow.
Well, it's definitely that, having worked in behavioral health, I still work in behavioral health, really, for manner of speaking. But as a chaplain, was having to tell people, and, you know, I had small groups each week on that particular unit, and just telling people, like, this is not a sin to be mentally ill. It's not a defect in character. It's an illness. And it was really struck. You said, like, with cancer, we get, I don't know what the tradition is in Canada, but in the South here in North Carolina, you get a casserole. People are very, you know, they come around to check on you and make sure you're doing well. You say that you got depression. Shit, you can check back in with us later when you're feeling better. Or they don't know what to say, period.
I think it's also, there's a strong sense. I mean, I think I know all the, like, you know, I know all the right things to say to other people who are struggling with depression. And yet when it comes to my own, I did all the same things that I told my congregation not to do, right? Like, I still struggle with the whole going and getting help, because that was a sign of weakness, right? Like, this is something I should be able to get over on my own. The first time it was suggested that I go on antidepressants, I was very anti medication. And on one hand, I was very supportive of that for other people. You know, I'd be the first one to say taking medication is not a sign of weakness. If it helps you, you know, thank God we have it, you know, it's a gift. But when it came to taking it myself, there was very much that sense of, oh, that's admitting that I can't get over this on my own. I'm weak. I'm giving in to, you know. So, I mean, I've had my own stigmas to get over in terms of my own feelings about my depression. So,
I think we all struggle with that to a certain extent. I know, you know, I've been open about the fact that I struggle with my mental health for years. I mean, I've been on this podcast with the guys for a couple of years. Like, I've never been one to hold back from talking about depressive episodes, but it just took me till last year to, like, accept and start being treated appropriately for bipolar. Mm-hmm. And that was all stigma. Like, that was, and I said, like, fuck no, I'm not bipolar. Like, I'm not going to be out. Like, I'll be out in the world as a person who suffers with depression, but I am not bipolar. Like, for whatever reason, like, that next step was just, like, too much for me. And it was, and I remember thinking similarly to you, like, why am I being so harsh with myself? Why am I telling myself all these things about stigmatization? Like, why am I stigmatizing myself when anyone else in my shoes, I'd be like, shit, I love you. We got to do what we got to do to take care of you. It's cool. Like, it's like, in some ways, yes, it's a disease. It's also not who you are. Like, let's take care of you. But for me, like, I could not do it. And especially in positions of leadership, like, I think modeling that is so important. You know, and that vulnerability is terrifying in faith communities where you're supposed to, like, have it together as the person in leadership.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, some of the fear about being open about it and being in a position of leadership was also, you know, like, for me, as someone with depression, it's this whole thing about, you know, I get overwhelmed, you know, I get physically and mentally exhausted, and that's often a trigger for the depression. But to talk about that, I don't want to send the message to my congregation, don't bother me with your problems because I'm struggling, right? So, right. I mean, I went through that with physical illness too. So you go through that sense of, like, you need to be open, and it's about modeling, but also I don't want to send the message that I can't handle helping mm-hmm. you because I've got too many of my own issues. And I remember a parishioner actually calling me one day about something, and he was saying, like, I know, because he follows me on Twitter, and he's like, I know you've been struggling this week, so I really didn't want to put more on you.
Aww.
Oh, that's not.
Aww.
And that made me, that, so then that starts to make you think, like, how open should I be, right?
Right. Well, like, I mean, and I know folks in church leadership that you know have the same kind of struggle with, like, chronic disease processes, right? And that's, you know, I guess, like, seeing your mental health as separate from another chronic disease process is where, like, that's where that disconnect starts to happen, right? Yeah. Like, if you've got rheumatoid arthritis and you're having a shitty week and, like, you physically can't go do home visits, you're not going to go do home visits, like, you know, but if your depression's flared up and, like, you're having trouble, you know, I shame myself over that in ways that I wouldn't over physical health things.
I still have the, you know, just, you know, pull yourself together conversation. Like,
yeah,
you're just having a really bad week and there's things I don't feel I can do. But like you're saying, if I was physically ill, I'd take a couple of days off and give myself that permission.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you should just be able to soldier through and push through it anyway, right?
Yeah. And that exacerbates it, right? So then you end up sick for longer. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of shame connected with it.
I know, it's really shitty.
And of course, faith communities are great at shame, right? Like,
yeah, we're really good.
We are masters at how to shame, keep the shame going.
It's our bread and butter, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I don't want to help people get over their shame because then I'm out of a job.
Right. It's that whole confessional industrial complex.
Yeah.
Nice.
That was nice. You spent the whole day thinking that one, didn't you?
I really like that.
No, that just came to me.
Give him a point.
Even that for everybody else, I still play into it for myself.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Well, it is that fine line. And so the question for you, but also for Chris, because Chris is also in a pulpit. Not that, Helena, you're not in, you know, leadership positions, but it's a little different.
Yeah, it is.
Is walking that fine line of being accessible and but being afraid that you're scaring the parishioner off from who also needs help. So what does that dance look like?
I think I terrified my congregation at one point because I was on so much medication that apparently I did a 5-minute sermon that I thought was 30 minutes long. I have no recollection of the message.
My congregation has a problem with the opposite. I think it's only 5 minutes and it's like way too long.
But I had, you know, it was just so doped up and I needed to be. But other than that, I don't think they know what to do. And some of that is the onus on ministers that preceded me. You know, we don't teach churches that this is an illness. This is an illness that's in so many homes and so many hind ends that are in the pews that it should be the one thing we could all say, like, hey, we know somebody with depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, something like that. Probably more people than we know have had cancer, or at least equally. Yeah, you know, I think that's where I'm at right now. Is how do we teach churches to not be phobic of depression or mental illness? I mean, some of it, you know, it's like I had more conversations with intern chaplains and first year chaplain residents when they make their sojourn to the psych unit, having to tell them, like, look, these people are not going to harm you. They're more likely to be harmed. You know, something like that. It is, and it's just a passion of mine. I get going on this. I'm about to mute myself for a minute.
Well, I mean, I think for me, it's been similar to my experience coming out as a gay man to the church. It's sort of like, how do congregations get over their phobia around that? And in my experience, it's been by being open and present and talking about it, right? Because then it normalizes. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, he's a gay guy, but he can still preach the gospel. He's, you know, he's married to a man, but, you know, they still have their same issues that any married couple has. And so part of it, getting them over that, is just seeing me living it out. And so if that's true for my sexuality, mm-hmm. why would that not be true also for, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with depression and other things? Mm-hmm. Putting it out there in front of them mm-hmm. normalizes it and helps mm-hmm. them.
So to then color this a little bit, and we tend to, especially in the West, have really elevated our image of what clergy are supposed to be. Right? You're supposed to be emblematic of how to live your life, and, you know, in terms of Christianity, you know, living the gospel, and in, you know, Judaism, you know, practicing halakha. So this idea that you're supposed to be, you know, not a human being, how much do you think that also sort of plays into the difficulty congregants have with acknowledging weakness? So even if we, not saying that it is a weakness, but since that is part of the stigma, you add to that stigma, well, you're not supposed to be human at all. You know, how is it, you know, so how do you think that adds to their reactions and how you have to work to overcome those things with them?
It's a strange thing. Like, I think it's this weird, and every tradition sort of navigates it slightly differently, I find. But I know, like, within my church, there's this sort of weird dichotomy between, on one hand, they want you to be just like them, right? Like, they want you to be one of the people. They don't want to put you up on a pedestal. They don't want you thinking of yourself up there. You're just like us. You have to be relatable and you have to be able to understand our lives. And at the same time, they don't want you to be quite like them. They want you to be slightly above it all. And it's weird to negotiate those two things because you're always getting it wrong one way or the other, right? You're going too far, like not relating to them, or you're too much like them and now they don't trust you as a leader. And I think part of it is also just being open with the people and talking about even that struggle. Like within my weekly prayer group that we have, I'll get my church ladies to pray for me about things that I'm struggling with as a leader. And that's, that kind of thing has helped them to see, like, he's still doing a good job as our leader, but it doesn't mean it's easy. You know, he's still our leader, but he's still a human being. And so I think it is important to help congregations understand that I, as the leader, I understand that pressure and that they kind of want me to be in two camps. And it's really a hard place to have a foot in two different camps.
I think it's one thing. I found it a lot easier now that I'm in a chaplaincy position and I'm not financially tied to a church per se, just to be a bit more bold in speaking out. But then I can remember that when I was in the depths of that depression, I didn't have the will or ability to articulate it. I was, like I said, I did the 5-minute sermon I have no recollection of doing and not sure if I even wrote it. I may have just got up there and drooled and moaned for 5 minutes for all I know. But, I didn't have the words, didn't have the language. And then it's the tough spot is with my own depression is I over-spiritualized it. This has got to be something demonic or something. It's got to be Satan, not serotonin. And it's, I find that even now that my faith, I'm a little more cautious, like, okay, if the Holy Spirit is speaking, is this, legitimate or is this mental illness or, I still find myself wary in approaching God at times. And I feel a lot more comfortable being vulnerable like that on a podcast. And again, not pastoring directly a church, but it's real.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the other relationship that I was going to ask Daniel about. And that is, so we're talking about, your relationship, obviously with yourself, your relationship with your church, but if you don't mind, addressing a little bit, your relationship with your own faith, your relationship with God, how is, dealing with depression, how does that change, affected, helped, hurt? What has that been for you?
Well, I mean, my faith, as it has in with all kinds of other struggles, I mean, I think one of the things that faith does is it can help us place our lives and our specific circumstances in a larger narrative, right? So, I mean, one of the things about, for me, at least with depression, is I become very narrowed and, my world and my sense of the world becomes very small and very dark. And my faith at least reminds me, I sometimes have a hard time connecting emotionally with it, but it reminds me that there's a bigger picture, there's someone bigger than me kind of involved in this, and my life is part of a larger picture, which has its victories and its hopes and its future as well. So that's, that's how it's helped. It's also given me a community of people who, while I sometimes struggle with how to present myself to that community, they pray for me, they care about me, they do want to help, even if they don't know how to help. So that's been helpful. But I do struggle sometimes because it's like, how do you go to God? What it's made me realize is that although I reject the idea that my depression or any kind of suffering is a punishment sent by God, I find that in my prayer, I still sometimes find myself angry or frustrated, like, why are you doing this to me? And I think to myself, you don't actually believe that. Like, theologically, that's not your belief, but here's yes. The conversation I'm having. Why are you doing this to me, Or why are you not helping more, I may not blame God for the depression, but I blame God for sitting on his ass and not doing enough to get me out of it. And then I start going down that road. If I follow that rabbit hole, I then go into, okay, so what am I doing wrong that God isn't helping me? Or what messages am I missing? Like, maybe God is trying to help me, but I'm not getting it. So it becomes this whole self guilt thing, like I'm doing something wrong or I would be better. And yeah, so I again, I don't know that that's really about my relationship with God as so much as it's about my relationship with God, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does.
What about you guys? How do you find our faith?
I needed a Jew, basically, other than the one that I had been following most of my life. Yeah. But, you know.
A European Ashkenazic one?
Ashkenazic.
Not a Middle Eastern Sephardic one?
Right, no, right.
He needed an Ashkenazi specifically.
Good.
He needed that monarchy in his life.
A royal smartass also helped. And the aid of tobacco and acceptable amounts of alcohol. No, but it was this, you know, I remember I was a patient, and then the chaplain of the same hospital unit I was a patient of. So we talk about like a mind, it just, you know, it was a trip, you know, walking in the first time, I was just like, okay, I can leave anytime I want to today. You know, it was tough. Even nurses remember me. It wasn't that many years prior that they had me as a patient. But it was this feeling of, and I did the same thing spiritually. I was like, you know what, God, just make this stop. Just make it stop. I'm whatever I've done, I'm sorry. You know, and I remember having the screaming match, which really was not well appreciated by the nurses that night. Me yelling at God, sitting on beds, cold sweat, coming off benzos and God knows whatever else. And then just, you know, it's, are you going to end this? You know, I need help. And so, you know, I survived, but I was at an impasse. And then I was at an impasse as how do I help others? So I had my old Jew, Charles there, use this great illustration. You know, I at least credit him with it till I find the actual source. But he said, like, it's like a guy that prays every night to win the lottery. And then wakes up every morning, hears the numbers, and is just depressed because, again, he didn't win. And he keeps repeating this. And Charles did it because he's half mystic anyway. And he said, do you get the point of this story? And so it took me a couple weeks. Then I finally said, he's not buying a ticket, is he? You know, and it sounds so obvious now, but it was such an epiphany of faith alone in your head, in your heart. You know, it's got to have those concrete actions. I had to say to myself, it's great that you believe in the Lord. Please take your medication as prescribed, when prescribed. See your therapist. Right. Get out of your room. Bathe regularly. Little things at first. But yeah, I mean, it's that's still a struggle.
The joke is the guy goes in, and so every day on his way to work, he stops in a church and he prays, God, just once, let me win the lottery. And he's been doing this for years. And finally, one day he's praying and God answers, says, Harry, do me a favor. Meet me halfway. Buy a ticket. It is a partnership and relationship with God. It's like what you're saying. You know, it's your relationship with your relationship, right? What am I missing? You know, is God putting things out there to help me? Like people who invent antidepressants. Yeah, people who go to school to become psychologists and psychiatrists and therapists, yeah, and, you know. Like,
so for me, my conversion really kind of helped orient me towards getting healthier, like mental, like with my mental health. Like my first major depressive episode after my conversion, it's kind of the first time that I didn't fight it. It was kind of the first time, you know, like my conversion was so kind of contingent on God's love, unconditionally, like unconditional love and acceptance and the purpose of vulnerability that it was actually the first time I went to go get medicine. Like it was the first time that I didn't fight so hard that I didn't get meds. And it's been an ongoing process. I mean, that's been 8 years now. Like I said, I just got sober about 5 years ago. I just, you know, finally got on a mood stabilizer about a year ago. It hasn't been quick, right? But it's been consistent for me to like kind of stop and say, wait a minute, you know, like I'll acknowledge when I'm ill now, whereas before I wouldn't, because I don't see that illness as weakness, because it's a partnership, right? Like it's not just me having to control things. Like I can give some of it to God and have support in a different way. It's also interesting because I think a lot about, you know, the pray it away or the, you know, seeing manifestations of mental illness as sin, and like and that gets layered on people in a way that's really unhealthy. But for me, like a lot of my process of getting healthy has been in some ways recognizing not the sin of being ill, but in not being vulnerable and reaching out for support, right? That this, it's not the illness that's a problem. It's my self-sufficiency and independence that disconnects me from other people or disconnects me from my relationship with God in those moments, right? But that's really like nuanced and tricky to talk to about people who are struggling on their own, right? And like I said, I would never want that to be mistaken as like, I'm sinning, so I'm sick, right? Like, but there is a piece of me, like my sobriety was kind of contingent on like, wow, you know, I behave in ways when I'm drinking that I would never in a million years behave sober, and in ways that really don't allow for a full relationship with God or my community, right? Same with my mental health, right? At some point I was like, whoa, I can't recognize myself in this, and I'm not connected to God, and I'm not connected correctly to the people that I love. And like, I need to get that back in order, right? But it is a really, it is a complex relationship, because when you're in the bowels of it, it's really easy to just say like, why have you forsaken me? I mean, that's what it feels like. Like, you understand that Gethsemane cry, right? Like in those moments.
Oh, I was going to say, and I think that's also part of the problem with, you know, the place of faith, is, you know, people would say to me like, well, have you prayed about it? And it's like, you know, my depression disconnects me from people, right? In my depression, mm-hmm. I do not want to talk to anybody. It's the same with God. Like, I don't want to talk to God either when I'm depressed. Yeah, it's really hard to just take it to the foot of the cross when it's like, I don't want to get out of bed and go anywhere, right?
Right.
So I think, yeah, that relationship between faith and depression and or any mental illness is difficult, because when you're in the midst of that, it's hard to do the work, even the mm-hmm. work stage, right? Which is to pray or to believe. Mm-hmm. And I, for me, like my depression was always, I remember thinking, I wish I could just have a complete breakdown, which sounds odd, but
no, dude, I feel not at all. We get it.
Because for me, it's like I was always able to just kind of keep going, like just and enough that it was hard to tell anybody that I was really ill or struggling, because they would look at me and go, "You're doing fine."
Dude, I feel you so hard.
So that someone will finally take me seriously and also look after me. You know?
Yeah. Like, I am not okay. No, you don't understand. I'm not okay. Yeah. Like, and at what point? No, I totally feel you on that. Yeah. And that point of like, but that's that fear of vulnerability piece again, right? And that to me is what I've learned. Like, that to me is like what I've learned through the narrative of Christ, right? Is that vulnerability. But that narrative doesn't, we talk about the victor like way more than we talk about how, what bravery and victory means. Like,
you're uncomfortable still with the humanity of Christ.
Yeah.
Very. Yeah, we don't like that very much, do we?
Oh, sorry. I was gonna say that came up actually for me really recently, because we were talking about the whole Gethsemane story. And it, like, how many people were like, well, Jesus was just doing that as an example to others who are struggling, like, you know, like, but he wasn't really feeling forsaken. He wasn't really afraid. And it was like,
no, he most definitely was. He was terrified. He was about to be crucified. Like,
yeah,
it's horrifying.
But anyway, again, it's that fear of the vulnerability. And like, you know, we're talking about how we as leaders in the community don't want to be vulnerable. It's like, we don't want our clergy or our faith leaders to be vulnerable, and we don't want our Lord to be vulnerable either, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's getting deep. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, my experience is a little different, obviously, for an obvious reason, because I have a different concept and relationship with God, but also because I'm the Incredible Hulk when it comes to depression. Yeah, Chris has changed that because he's heard this before.
I've heard this one. That's enough. It's fair.
What's my secret? I'm always depressed. I have chronic severe depression. So I've been this way since like 7. You know, that is, so it's not like, yes, you know, some days are worse than others. And I've had a couple of, you know, severe depressive episodes in my life. But for the most part, this is pretty much, since I was 7, my nightly prayer has just been, I don't want to wake up tomorrow. You know, and as I forget who said it, you know, it's not that I want to die, I just don't want to live anymore. Yeah. You know? So that kind of changes it. But it's also the fact, and this is part of my Judaism, is never felt abandoned, never felt forsaken, never blame God or anything, because, you know, it's my understanding God's always there. Right. So that was never been an issue. Where it manifests, you know, because I talk to God every time. Like I talk to God every night before I go to bed about, okay, come on, seriously. Can we just end this? You know, I've agreed to be here for 59 years. I think that's past the term of the contract. Can we just, you know, let's cash it in already. But where it has manifest, especially when I'm in the deepest, and it's still kind of odd for me, for reasons where I've had trouble with my local Jewish community, I have not been to synagogue in a number of years, obviously now because of COVID. But there's a point in every service just before we read from the Torah where they bring it around and everybody kisses it, you know, to honor it and everything. And for like the last several years, I've been unable to do that. And it has nothing to do with, oh, you know, God has abandoned me, so I'm not going to honor God's word. It's all been about, I just don't feel worthy of God's help and healing right now, you know? So I know it's there, you know, it's part of Judaism is God's like, you know, just return. I didn't go anywhere, right? So, you know, Genesis, you know, Adam and Eve went and hid, right? And God said, okay, where are you? Like God didn't know where they were, right? But it was on them because that's what God's saying, right? I know you're there. I haven't gone, but it's up to you. You have to come out now. Right. You have to buy a ticket. Right. Meet me halfway, buy a lottery ticket. And just, you know, I just don't feel like I'm worth doing that. So it's a different, you know, dynamic there for those reasons. So on the one hand, you know, I'm like, yeah, God's there. God didn't go anywhere. You know, God didn't do this to me, you know, other than in creating a world in which this occurs. But I don't blame God for the evil in the world either, because even though God created that, we're the ones who perpetrate it. Yeah. And, you know, and I understand that, you know, God helped me because there's antidepressants and, you know, I had a deep enough depressive episode that my wife said, you go to the psychiatrist or I leave. So I've been on antidepressants ever since then. But it's like, you know, yes, I know that if I buy that lottery ticket, not that my depression will go away, but I'll feel a little better. But part of the depression is not feeling worthy of feeling better.
And it's this, yeah. It's the struggle with, it's the feeling thing, right? Because so much, I know that depression lies, as they say, right?
It's right, like, exactly.
This, how I feel isn't necessarily reflective of reality, but it's really hard to engage with the reality outside of how I'm feeling about it. There's at the end of our liturgy, there's always a prayer, you know, based on scripture. It goes, you know, glory to God, whose power working in us can do infinitely more than we can ask or imagine. And there's times when that prayer brings me to tears because I see that and I believe that. And there's times when I say that prayer through gritted teeth because I'm like, I don't see any power working in me doing anything, but I'll say it anyway. You know, and maybe others will believe this for me until I can believe it myself, which is, I guess, part of also faith community is that people.
I was just gonna say, let other people carry it for you when you can't, right?
Yeah, that's also, you know, when I was a youth director, you know, Jews pray three times a day, or you know, the more ritual observant ones. And so we had this discussion. You know, what do you do with the kid who says, "Well, I don't feel like praying today"? And the point is that, no, you don't wait till you feel like it. Yeah, you keep praying, and eventually one day you'll feel like it, right? But if you haven't been exercising the muscles and practicing, then, you know, what are you going to do with that day you wake up? Oh, I think I'll pray today. Oh, how do I do that? You know, so it's like, just, whereas my father, the great advice my father gave to all of us when we all, my siblings and I, when we each married, was keep saying I love you and pretty soon you'll believe it. You know, so it's like, so keep saying that prayer, you know, whether you believe it, but pretty soon, eventually, right?
I have a friend who used to say, her children are all grown up now, but she was in seminary with me, and she used to say her children were like, you know, preteens at the time, and she'd say, you know, I hug my daughter because I love her, and I hug my daughter so I will love her.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's days when your hands start to go kind of around her neck instead of around her body, but, you know, you do it until you feel it.
Mm-hmm. We could go on, and we tend to, but I think this is a good place that we can at least end this portion of this discussion. And of course, you know, you have an open invitation at always anytime, and not just even talking about mental health. If you want to come on and talk about anything else.
Yeah, we'll talk about
about anything on this show. We have no shame.
It's all fair game.
It's all fair game. So I want to thank you again for Daniel Brereton for joining us, for sharing and being vulnerable.
Yes.
The few people that we know do listen to our podcast who have actually spoken to us about it. For most of those people, these are the kind of podcasts they appreciate the most.
Yes.
Thank you.
So thank you very much for being part of it and putting up with us too. That's not easy.
It's been fun.
So we're going to move to words of wisdom, which as always are totally arbitrarily chosen with no regard to our topic or what's going on in the world.
Absolutely nothing.
Is only because it's his
randomly picked.
Yeah, randomly picked. Stephen Fry, comedian and fellow member of the tribe.
Is he now?
Yes, he is.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he is. I do want to say that, yes, this is a quotation that is about depression because he's also a depressive. But I do want to, before I read it, take the personal privilege to bitch about the fact that if you go to any quotation site and you search for quotations on depression, they're always included with other quotations about motivation and inspiration.
Oh, that's some shit.
Isn't it? It is. So like I'm reading this one about really deep about what depression is. And the next one is, if you're in hell, keep going. You know, don't be defeated by feeling sad. And I'm like, oh, God.
Oh, God, yeah. We didn't even talk about that. Depression and sadness are not the same
yet. Until you make it.
Stop it. Oh, my God. I just want like a billboard.
Yeah. So after I read through them, I just went and had to take a shower because it was just so damn depressing.
God. Yeah.
Wash all that motivation off you. Just get rid of it.
One of those Silkwood showers?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Going back to the Holy Grail, that's one of my favorite scenes, though, is when God sends him on the quest. And it's like, what are you doing? Groveling. Well, don't. Yes, oh, Lord. What are you doing now? Averting our eyes. Well, stop it. Sorry, Lord. Oh, that's another thing I can't stand. People always apologizing. Every time I go to talk to someone, it's forgive me that. I'm so sorry. I'm not worried. It's like those Psalms are so depressing. I love the guy's like, no, don't. I just want to talk to you. You know, stop groveling and apologizing. Anyway, from Stephen Fry. Back to Stephen Fry. If you know someone who's depressed, please resolve never to ask them why. Depression isn't a straightforward response to a bad situation. Depression just is, like the weather. Try to understand the blackness, lethargy, hopelessness, and loneliness they're going through. Be there for them when they come through the other side. It's hard to be a friend to someone who's depressed, but it is one of the kindest, noblest, and best things you will ever do.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
I'm Helena Epstein, and I'm still the Ampersand of Reason.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah. Wishing I could change
the things that I... Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire. Can't give back the hand if you didn't like the deal. You made your choices, you gotta live with that. If you learn from
all the snakes, you'll get another chance at that.